With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. This is War of the Worlds on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I'm George Eliason, and this is the new radio broadcast from TNT, breaking the news of the War of the Worlds. In front of the microphone, you won't be hearing armchair generals and think tankers paid to run propaganda for NATO and the Biden administration. This microphone is fitted with a special filter to keep the propaganda and false expertise out. This is not the hour for repeating what you've already heard and rehashing what you already know. This isn't a crosstalk of reporters pushing their bylines in exchange for your money. And this isn't the BBC's hard talk with its soft-centered confectionery manufactured at the Foreign Office and MI6. They are the alien invaders. This is the hour when you'll be able to hear the news breaking from the news fronts throughout Europe and from your ears to your brains, not the alien invaders, but the fresh, original human analysis of what the breaking news means. So sit tight. Here goes. On today's show, we have Simeon Boyko, a.k.a. the Aussie Cossack, back for his third hour. If you weren't listening, you can listen to his show. Comes on 2 hours before War of the Worlds at the Aussie Cossack Show on TNT.live. You can also find him on Twitter at Aussie Cossack. That's A-U-S-S-I-E. COSSACK, and on Facebook at the Aussie Cossack. Simeon, welcome to the show, and where else can people find you?
Thank you very much, George. Well, probably the best place to check out my stuff would be on Telegram, and I'm a big fan of Telegram, so at Aussie Cossack on Telegram, about 10 to 15 times a day, we update news and information on there. We just posted actually an interesting segment. Senator Ralph Babette from Victoria, Australia, a few minutes ago declared that Canberra should immediately stop supplying drones and weapons to Ukraine. And this comes, of course, off the back of that attack on the Kursk airfield, in which Australian drones were used, these cardboard pizza box drones. So that's in Australia quite a serious topic, and we're not very happy at all that these Australian drones, initially they were intended, our government in Australia told us that they were for humanitarian purpose, for observation purposes, to drop medicine and supplies to Ukrainian troops. And now they're actually being used on Russian targets in mainland Russia. So Australians are not happy about that. They feel as though they've been tricked by the Australian government.
Now, are they worried about the fact that because these weapons are used to attack heartland Russia, that this actually opens Australia up to some form of retaliation, whether it's diplomatic or otherwise?
Well, that's exactly right. At the moment, Russia is preoccupied, but doesn't mean that Russia can't answer with reciprocal measures down the track in the future. In fact, Russia doesn't even have to directly retaliate and attack Australia in response. And of course, we hope that there won't be any type of attacks. And I've always been an advocate for peace between Australia and Russia. But what Russia can do, and most likely will do, is in the future, if Australia was to be involved in any conflicts where it was to intervene with its military into the affairs of a small country, as the West does all the time, as we know, whether it would be in the Middle East, in Africa, and in Australia's case, in the South Pacific. Australia's been very active lately, having military exercises in the South China Sea, in the Pacific Ocean, together with the Indian Navy, the Japanese Navy. And we know that Australia is concerned about the Chinese presence in the Pacific. These little island countries that are off Australia's coast, for example, the Solomon Islands, Fiji. What if Russia reciprocated, returned the favor, and armed Australia's neighbors, potential adversaries, with all sorts of different weapons? I mean, Australia sent cardboard drones. They call them the pizza box drones. And although they're cheap to build and they're cheap to make, they obviously are effective, having breached Russian airspace, 170 kilometers deep into Russia. Now, the question is here, the British, the Germans, and even the Americans have been very strict, as we know. Let's take, for example, the British Storm Shadow cruise missile. The British were very strict on the Ukrainian government. You can use this only to defend yourself. So basically, only to hit targets within the zone of the special military operation, not to hit targets in the Russian mainland. So Australia has been basically set up by the Ukrainian government. I highly doubt that the Ukrainian government sought permission to bomb the Russian mainland, 170 kilometers inland. And incidentally speaking, today in the Bryansk region, just a few hours ago, there was also a drone attack. And the drones that were used look suspiciously like Australian SIPAC drones. Same sort of setup, cardboard shape, the silhouette looks exactly the same, the propeller. So it does look very suspicious. And this is something that the Australian government, the Australian people should be concerned about. Russia doesn't need to retaliate now.
What kind of payload can they carry? Do you have any idea?
It's basically a 5 kilogram payload, and it's quite an innovative, this drone, cheap to make, made of cardboard. But that's the thing, because it's made of cardboard, I'm reliably informed that it's able to go around the usual sort of drone defense tactics that they usually use. So they've been successful, and Australia is giving about 100 of these drones a month, 100 a month. And in that attack a few days ago on the Kursk airfield, where Ukraine claimed they took out a few Russian Su-35 fighters and a few MiGs, or Russia disputes those claims, they used Australian drones. That's definitely confirmed. So you've got drones that cost, you know, $5,000 hitting Russian fighter jets, which cost, as we know, millions, tens of millions. But the Australian government, the Australian media have been quiet about this. I don't think they're in a hurry to claim victory or to claim that as their win, which is nice. It's sobering to see that people in Canberra, in the government, and of course Canberra controls the Australian media, have been smart enough to realise that this is not something that Australia should be proud of. This is something that Australia should be saying, well, this wasn't us and we didn't give permission for this. We were basically tricked. The Australian public was fed a story that these drones are good for observation, for dropping medicine. That's a quote.
Right.
It's all over the news. Dropping medicine, dropping supplies. And what have the Ukrainians done? They're using them in offensive capacity. This is why Western countries should be careful before they arm Ukraine. Hitting targets in Kursk.
They're doing that with everything. Anything you give the Ukrainians, this is what they've done. This is what they're going to do. Even John McCain, he actually flipped out. This is going back to 2015, about Ukrainians using cluster bombs, because they use those weapons not against military targets, but against civilians, you know, as a general rule. Even he spoke out against it. And we know where McCain was in all this. He didn't want the U.S. Involved in or blamed for war crimes. And the Australian government might just be waking up to this, you know, this concept right now because of this. That's what you're saying?
Well, there is pressure. You see, pressure from the constituency, the Australian government. I see that they are reluctant to continue their support for several reasons. The first reason being that it's extremely unpopular. The public opinion in Australia has changed. Australians, in general, in nature, they love to support the underdog, whether it's in rugby or basketball or cricket. It's in the Australian nature to support the team that's losing. Now, in the beginning of the conflict, with all the hype going in the media, Australia sort of threw itself to Ukraine's aid. And as time goes on, when people are realizing, well, Ukraine is not that innocent, and it's actually Russia who's the underdog. It's Russia who's fighting against NATO, against 35-plus countries. It's Russia who is defending its people in those Russian-speaking south and eastern regions. And as the informational war unfolds, and as the, thanks to, of course, alternative media sources other than the mainstream media, for example, Telegram channels, very, very good in spreading awareness about what's actually happening in the special military operation, Australians' opinion are changing. The opinions of Australians en masse are changing. And the support in Australia for supplying Australian money, weapons, and so forth is drying up. Now, the main reason for that is the fact that Australia simply doesn't have the weapons. And we've been constantly reminding Australia, you've got China in the Pacific, you've got strong nations in the Pacific who are armed to the teeth. You can't afford to be giving anything to Ukraine. You can't afford to be sending away Australian armored personnel carriers, even though they're old, those armored personnel carriers from the days of the Vietnam War. That's all we've got here. And meanwhile, the Ukrainian government, the Ukrainian ambassador in Australia, Vasyl Myrushnichenko, they're demanding, they want Australia to give up its 59 Abrams tanks. We only have 59 in storage, right? And they want them. And it's this window shopping attitude to what Australia has. What else have you got there? We'll take two of those, five of those, and 50 of those. And the Australian people are sick of that. I mean, Australia doesn't owe Ukraine any obligation. Australia and Ukraine are not in a military alliance. There's no obligation for Australia to be involved. And I think once the Australian general public and even the Australian politicians and military brass, once they realise that this is not a quick war, this is a serious war, this is probably World War III. Many people believe that this is the beginning of World War III. You probably think so as well. I think so as well. This is the beginning stages. This is, so to speak, the 1939, you know, or the 1941. And this is only going to get worse. We've been campaigning in Australia to keep Australia out of it. And I think that campaigning is going well, especially now that in the United States, there's a significant change in the view of supporting Zelensky. Again, Trump.
Well, people are catching up.
People are catching up. That's slowly flowing down to the Australians. And it's going to be funny when America turns its back on Ukraine and idiots like Prime Minister Albanese in Australia will be left holding the baby. So it's better to bail now for Australia to just declare neutrality. And that's one thing that Senator Babbitt, just a few minutes ago, on the opposition podcast with Avi Yemeni and Rukshan Fernando from Melbourne, has just announced. He said we should be neutral. I'm very pleased that we are hearing this. Australia, of course, is a major partner of the United States, being a member of the AUKUS alliance. So if Australia sort of gives up, caves, their support dries up, it could be a domino effect.
Well, it's been really interesting that way because he started in Europe with all this, the window shopping, as you described. And what is left in anyone's coffers for defense? I mean, what's actually left in the garages at this point? You know, if you can't keep up with the something simple like shell production, you know, for your own needs and support Ukraine at the same time, I mean, you should already be well stocked if you're a country. But you've given everything away, and this isn't just a country, this is going across Europe. Or tanks, or bullets, or this or that. And it's just any political group in any of these countries should say, you know, to stand up, ask one question. What do we have left for defense? Or did you send it all to Ukraine?
In Australia's case, it's actually quite embarrassing. In the last shipment of weapons Australia gave Ukraine, 17 trailers. Now, I'm not talking about some special trailers or some, even trailers for trucks or something military-like, just normal standard trailers, civilian trailers painted olive green to make them sort of military-like. But that's, we're scraping the bottom of the barrel. It's a laughing stock. You don't have anything to send, well, don't send anything. And I've said to the Australian public many times here in our broadcasts and our commentary of the situation, that every time the Australian Prime Minister, the Australian Defence Minister, Richard Miles, make a decision, make an announcement to send weapons to Ukraine, China is sitting back and, you know, with the popcorn and laughing and watching and saying, yeah, send whatever you got, keep sending it. You know, initially, in the beginning of the Special Operation, Australia actually sent missiles. And now we're on a spending spree in Australia, spending billions, trying to buy missiles from the United States, Tomahawk missiles, HIMARS missiles, And there's a global shortage of weapons. You know, there's a global shortage of HIMARS missiles. So we look like idiots now. We've got China here. We've got Indonesia, 240 million people, big army. They've got Russian planes, Russian submarines. Australia does not have anything to defend itself with. We don't have the capabilities. So, again, the Bushmaster, the Australian Bushmaster, used to be a truck with a good reputation. Once it hit the
Ukraine.
Yeah, and now everyone knows that it's garbage. So Australia's lost its credibility, its reputation, and for what? For Zelensky. It was always a bad idea to get involved. But, George, I think the situation is changing. Australians are waking up. Australians generally, whether they support Russia or Ukraine, there's one thing they can all agree on. It's not our fight. We shouldn't be part of it. We should not be involved. And that's a great position. And I know many Australians that they don't care about Russia. And I'll say, that's fine. You don't have to care about Russia. You need to care about Australia. Put Australia first. Putting Australia first.
I say the same thing about America all the time. We've got to take a quick break. I want to pick it up right here when we get back. Now, before we go, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest or host that you'd like to hear on TNT Radio? Or perhaps you have a topic you feel we should discuss? Well, then we want to hear from you. Simply complete the suggestion form on the TNT Radio website. Help us make a difference on TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
We don't expose and oppose the various scams, cons, and psyops comprised by the globalist agenda merely to be obstreperous, obstructionist, or contrarian. No, we do it because it's important for people to know the truth. And the truth is that the scamdemic was used to increase government control and funnel massive amounts of taxpayer dollars into private pockets via the bioindustrial complex. The truth is that climate change is a scientific fraud being used to increase government control and to funnel massive amounts of taxpayer dollars into private pockets via alternative energy companies. The truth is that those in power use that power for control and profit. That's the equation. Power equals control plus profit. That's why we speak out against these things, and that's why you should too. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Imagine two chocolates side by side. The same size, shape, color. The only difference? One chocolate has a hazelnut center. So is it the one on the left or the right? Breast cancer can be a little like that hidden hazelnut. On the outside, your breast might look and feel fine, but on the inside? To really see what's going on, you need to have a breast screen. Recommended for women over 50, it's quick and it's free. Call Breast Screen SA on 132050 today. A message from the Government of South Australia.
There's something about living here. The skies that change right before your eyes. And people that look out for each other. A community that does its bit to plan and prepare to keep everyone safe. Because bushfire is just a part of life here. We've been through it before, and we'll get through it again. We live with bushfire, so we live bushfire ready.
You're listening to War of the Worlds with George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, we're back with Simeon Boyko, a.k.a. the Aussie Cossacks, speaking from the Russian embassy in the Russian consulate in Sydney. Now, I wanted to pick up where you left off, but I also want to get into why you're at the consulate right after that. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. Now, we were talking about, it's not just, you know, Australia's reputation, it's America's reputation, Europe's reputation. Because Zelensky is, you know, I think that the main thing, and you've been hitting it on the head, is that he's lying to everybody. He's lying about how the war is going. He's lying about why the war started. He's lying about the conduct of the war. And, I mean, what I'm hearing from the front lines right now is that Russian soldiers are actually starting to have mental issues because of the amount of carnage left every time the Ukrainians try to do a push. It's just they're not being equipped. They're just dying. And the amount of Ukrainian soldiers' bodies on the battlefield in some areas is just insanely high. It's almost like stacking cordwood. Is the Australian government even hearing any of this? Because this is a reality.
Oh, absolutely. The situation for the Ukrainians is dire. It's futile. They've thrown everything they have. They've given, so to speak, the best that they've got. It's very sad. And I know it's very sad for, as you mentioned, Russian soldiers who are having to face huge losses from Ukraine.
It's not the Russian losses.
I know. It's the Ukrainian losses. I know what you're talking about. It's Russian soldiers having to watch the amount of death from the Ukrainian side. Mounds upon mounds of Ukrainian troops, throwing them into battle in Rabotino, in other parts of the front line. It's very sad. It is quite sad. And I believe that in the future, once Russia liberates Ukraine, these huge cemeteries, these military cemeteries where these Ukrainian soldiers are buried, there should be monuments and plaques put up with a reminder. And it should read that these men were killed by NATO. These men were murdered by Biden, by Zelensky, because that's what they died for. They're dying for Zelensky and NATO. NATO don't care how many Ukrainians die. It's not their people. It's not their blood. It's our people. It's our blood. It's our people. It's our Orthodox people that are dying. That's why Russia conducted this military operation with one hand tied behind its back. I mean, our kindness, exactly. the Russian kindness is sometimes misinterpreted by the West as being weakness. It's not about being weak at all. We elected not to destroy Ukraine. We chose to preserve as much Ukrainian life as possible. In fact, in the first days of the special military operation, in late February and early March, Russian units were told, don't shoot at Ukraine. Don't shoot at the Ukrainian troops, because we wanted them to come over to our side like it was in Crimea. And I think the whole Crimean situation, the brilliant operation in Crimea, it sort of gave us this hope. Maybe you could say we're a little bit influenced by that, a little bit drunk on that euphoria of Crimea, where we were able to take the whole peninsula with not even one casualty either side. And, of course, we were hoping for that. Russian units, Rosgvardia units sent into battle without artillery, without the classic sort of military strategy, because we were hoping for a collapse within. I was hoping, of course, in the first days of the war, I'm sure as you were, that things would be finished quickly. You know, my prediction was that Russia would take a line running from the Belarusian border through Zhytomyr down to Pridnestrovia, along that line. To me, in the beginning, that made the most sense, and just leave the western part of Ukraine to the west. You know, they want to join Europe, go join Europe. You're welcome. We don't need you. The west of Ukraine, these western Ukrainian cities, such as Lvov, Ivano-Frankivsk, Ternopil, they'll never be part of us. Even if we occupy them or liberate them, they'll be fighting us using, you know, partisan guerrilla warfare. But, of course, you know, those regions, the southeast, central Ukraine, they should have joined us. And somewhere we're probably partly to blame. Personally, maybe you'll agree with me here, George, but I think we should have just pressed on in 2014. We shouldn't have listened to the West. We shouldn't have made any deals, any Minsk agreements, any peace deals, because as we know now, that was not a peace deal. That was a deal to stop the Russian army, to stop the army of Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics from advancing, to give the Ukrainians time to regroup and rearm.
You know, let's be clear about it. I mean, it wasn't... the Russians at that point, all through that, all they had here were advisors. Even Crimea. Crimea was a local phenomenon. There were some special circumstances, like the buses coming out of Kiev going back to Crimea after Maidan, where there needed to be an intervention to rescue those people. But the only reason why And, you know, this isn't a gripe against Russia because they had to do this. The only reason why Minsk was supportable at all was the fact that Russian troops were not engaged openly in the Donbas area, the Donbas region. And this has been 9 years for me and the people here, 9 long years. And some of these frontline towns, the same frontline for 9 years. I spoke to somebody yesterday. They're, let's see, 2 days before, the bus they were supposed to get on got hit. Okay, you had some people that died. It's the same neighborhoods, and they count themselves lucky if, you know, you get one strike in your yard. One person, you know, their personal guard that they use, you know, this is what they eat all winter, and this is definitely front line. The garden, there were 2 tomato plants left. But that's life on the front lines. Now, with what Russia did at the beginning, when it was just a special military conflict or expedition back in, let's say, March, April 2022, that peace agreement that they signed was Ukraine's only victory. I mean, can you imagine that particular thing where you sign, you know, okay, we're having a peace agreement, we'll pull our troops out. Ukraine claims a victory, they beat up the Russians, kick them out of West Central Ukraine. Woohoo. I mean, what do you think Vladimir Putin was thinking at that point when it became clear that this was just a ploy?
Well, when it became clear, so recently, well, I think he had the best intentions. I think he was trying to be as honorable as possible, and he trusted the West. And I, as many other people, as many people all across Russia, in particular the Russian Donbas, were pushing for Russia to just finish the job, to do it properly. Because if we had finished the job, then we actually would have actually saved the lives of these Ukrainians who are dying now for no reason.
Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians.
We could have saved them. And they were waiting for us. Kharkov was waiting for us. Mariupol was waiting for us. Odessa was waiting for us. All over the country, it could have been a domino effect. And I think that this was all the West's plan. And the blood is directly on the West's hands. Going back to 1991, they want to talk about those borders and those agreements. Well, those agreements said that Ukraine and Russia are in a union, are allies, are brotherly nations. So any agreements that were made in 91 are void when Ukraine has NATO advisors, NATO instructors, NATO mercenaries, and its government effectively is occupied as an American proxy. So it's like a nightmare.
But
it's like
those
a nightmare scenario.
Borders, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but the only actual borders Ukraine ever had were on the west side. To the north with Belarus, the border is still being negotiated. It could go 50 miles either way. If this whole thing hadn't blown up, and we were just talking about, you know, let's say Donbas was still part of Ukraine, and Ukraine wanted to settle a recognized border with Russia, that border could move 50 miles in either direction. They were demarcated, or delineated rather, but they were never demarcated. They were never set as solid, this is an international border, and it all rests on administrative borders from the Soviet Union. So what border are we talking about? And the Ukrainian scholars even remarked on this, well, Ukraine at some point wants to make money off this, they, you know, get negotiation points and something, so they're not going to settle the border till that point. And, you know, that's the case right now. So there's never a border. So what are we talking about? Russia can extend, you know, what border are we talking? 1919? 1920, you know, if you go to 1921, we're still over at Poland. 1918, we're over at Poland. 1914, we're over to Poland. If you go 200 years before that, well, there was no Poland. So it was over, you know, what's the next European country over? You know, we're looking at Germany then, or Prussia. Until, you know, you get about 240 years ago, there was a kingdom of Poland. So what borders are we talking about? Until 100 years ago, every single person in what's now called Ukraine was a Russian citizen. They were Russian. If you ask them about it, none of them wanted to be Ukrainian. It was just a political movement. And that is the mix across Ukraine right now in terms of people's attitudes. Now, you've had the propaganda for 9 years. That's all they've been fed. So, yeah, you have a lot of brainwashing. But across Ukraine, all these people are told to spit at their grandparents and great-grandparents who fought in the Great War. They're not heroes. They fought against the saviors, the Germans. What are you talking about? Because they're given all the Bandera that helped the Germans, all the Melnik that helped the Germans, medals, and taking it away from the Soviet soldiers. Taking away their pensions, taking away all this. So I think that, you know, what you said is true. They're waiting, but now they're starting to see this isn't going to happen and that they've lost heart. Do you agree that's a fair statement?
I think absolutely. It's heartbreaking just to imagine what the veterans of World War II, the remaining veterans who are alive, and to be honest, any of that generation, those people, those Soviet people born in the Soviet Union, what they probably must be thinking, looking at what's going on, looking at what went on since 2014, the return of Nazism to Ukraine, a Nazi government, a government which glorifies the collaboration of Ukrainian soldiers fighting in the SS, fighting within the German military. It's terrible. It's a tragedy. And it's all because Russia is too kind. That's just what it comes down to. Again, we need to be much stronger. We need to be much stronger right now. I'm not saying we're weak. It's where the perception is that we're weak because we're being nice, because these people are our people. They're just misguided, these Ukrainian people. They're misguided and they're temporarily occupied by a pro-Western government. So it makes it very tragic and all of this. And I mean, I know personally a friend of mine who's in my class. I studied in Moscow in the Moscow Slikinsky Seminary. When I was 18, I left Australia, moved to Moscow, and for a few years I studied there. And one of the guys was from Ukraine. His name, I'll tell you his name, Bogdan Pavlushenko. And his father's a priest. And the Ukrainian mobilization agents came to the church and they said, "We'll take your dad." And he goes, "All right, don't take your dad. My dad is a priest. Take me." And this guy's a seminarian. He helps his father in the church. He's not even, he's not a military person. He's, you know, he's not aggressive at all. I remember him. And he's like a Russian speaking. He's a Russian person in Ukraine, right? Father's a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarch. And they took him. 3 days later, he was dead. 3 days later, they took him, sent him to a part of the front line. And it's almost as though I'm starting to think that I'm convinced, in fact, that they're committing genocide. They're targeting the Orthodox people. They're targeting the Russian-speaking
That's what I've been pointing out for, 6 years now. It's exactly that. And it's been on the agenda, believe it or not, since 1919, that there were certain groups that could never be forgiven. They were apostate to Ukrainian nationalism. All of Donbass was one. People that didn't agree with them. And you're pegging the war perfectly, and most people won't see that. They're getting rid of all the Russians. Their commanders at the front lines are talking to conscripts now, calling them expendables. They're not giving them gear. They're throwing them to the front, battles they can't win. And, you know, like we discussed at the beginning of the program, it's exactly what it's set up for. See, Ukraine doesn't need a lot of people because it's, you know, they had a fire sale. The country is sold. But the people that they want to have are Ukrainian nationalists. So if there's only 10 of those, there'll be 10 people living in Ukraine at the end of this.
The historical lesson is that we cannot trust the West, and we can't be kind. We can't be nice. We can't play by their rules. We need to be like the Soviet Union was, like the Russian Empire was. They need to fear us. We need to have a large military. We need to have our missiles, rockets, guns, tanks, artillery, everything ready and pointed at them. We need to have a standing army of a couple of million, as it always was. We need to have troops along our borders. In fact, we need to take in those countries who want to be with us. We need to help our allies wherever they are around the world. Yes, it was an expensive strategy. Yes, it was economically damaging, but it was a good strategy because they feared us. People ask me sometimes, are you a monarchist? Do you support the Soviet Union? I say to them, well, I don't care either one, whether we have a return to the Soviet style or the Russian imperial style. The most important thing for me personally is that the West is afraid, that in America they're practicing bomb shelter drills when they think about us. And they don't dare arm our enemies. They don't dare send mercenaries against us or send drones to bomb our peaceful cities, attack our people. And that's the most important thing. We tried to be friends with them. We tried to do the right thing. Vladimir Putin tried. I mean, what Yeltsin did, of course, what Gorbachev did was complete treason, absolutely treason. They became the victims of an American intelligence operation, and they destroyed our country. They cut up our country into a dozen or so smaller nations, and of course, all of this land, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, the Baltic states, all of those countries, East Germany, Poland. These are countries that we earned with blood. We didn't get them for free. Like they got them in 1991 at the stroke of a pen. And that was, of course, the mistake that was made, if you want to call it the original sin. And everything goes from that day. The treason which was committed by Gorbachev, by Yeltsin, and of course, Vladimir Putin, he came to save Russia's predicament, and he did a great job, but my only criticism of him is that he trusted them too much. We're in this position because we thought the West was honorable. We thought the West could be trusted. The West are conniving. They're evil. They're sick. They want to see Ukrainians be killed by Russians. They want to see Russians be killed by Ukrainians. They're happy to supply hundreds of billions of dollars as long as the blood flows. They're the ones that pushed Ukraine into this. They're the ones that pushed Russia into this. I mean, when Russia entered Afghanistan, way back in the days of the Soviet Union, the CIA was cheering. There was a party in the Pentagon because they said, oh, we finally got them. We finally are going to give the Soviet Union its version of our Vietnam. But what's happened now tops everything, tops all the charts, again, because we didn't believe that the West was so evil. We didn't believe that the West was going to go in there and fight and arm the Ukrainians and give the Ukrainians cruise missiles, tanks, armored personnel carriers, drones, most importantly, the intel, satellite imagery, satellite intel, HIMARS missiles, the combination of...
Well, there's actually something that's a little bit, we'll say different. We've got to take another break. I want to pick this up when we get back. This is War of the Worlds, and we've got the Yossi Cossack with us today, and this is a lively discussion. We'll see you in a few minutes.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
I wrote a book 3 years ago, and if you haven't picked it up, you should. It's called The Weaponization of Weather in the Phony Climate War. And we are seeing just examples right out of that book. First of all, we have these people with the WEF that are talking about climate lockdowns and how COVID set the stage to condition people to them. And there are two chapters in that book, and it was written in April of 2020, predicting that was going to happen. In the meantime, the weaponization of weather and the phony climate war continues. Leading the way, of course, is Joe Biden. And he is claiming that because of all the warm water in the Gulf of Mexico, climate change is enhancing hurricanes. Apparently, he is blissfully unaware. And any hurricane fanatic knows what's coming up. September 4, 1933. Two major hurricanes hit the United States within 18 hours of each other. Not only that, but they didn't develop in the backyard. They came all the way across the Atlantic, which meant they had much more what we call kinetic energy. They were bigger storms. They took up a longer period of time. These little systems that spin up, they're little in size, they're strong at the center, are all occurring during the phase of the Madden-Julian Oscillation favorable for it. Every single one of them. You know, Harvey, Ida, all the storms in the around 2020, Ian, every single one of them, Michael. And yet we have this particular person saying these things constantly. And I called it plumbing the depths of dumb, because that's what they're doing. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't realize it. Now, let me get a little bit serious here, because we have Typhoon Haku, and even though the other one missed and went to Hong Kong, Typhoon Haku is coming right at Taiwan, and it is a major typhoon, so they're going to get hit right on the noggin this weekend. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you've got.
Some children don't have what other children have. Some children don't get regular meals. Some children don't have a place to live. Some children don't have a safe place to go to sleep. All until something changed. Someone cared. Someone cared enough to give them a chance. A healthy meal. Someone cared enough to give them a safe home. Cared enough to give them a warm bed. Someone foster cared. Truth is, there's lots of kids in need and not enough care. If you're ready to be the care in foster care, call Barnardo's on 1800 663 441. Because every child needs a champion.
All good with you, Jack?
Yeah, mate. Not bad, you know. Can't complain.
How's the farm?
Yeah. All good, all good.
Yeah, that's right, Jack. All good, all good. Apart from pretty much everything. Years of drought, and now it won't stop raining. Lose this crop and I could lose it all. Dad'll turn in his grave. Jess'll move to the city, find a better guy, and I'll be left on my own with the dogs. Oh, it's not so bad, except once they take the farm, I'll have nowhere to keep the dogs. Mate, I just don't know how I'm going to get through this.
Yeah, I'm struggling a bit myself.
Yeah?
Yeah, but we'll pull through, mate.
Let your inner voice out at the men's table. Search themenstable.org for details.
This is War of the Worlds on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Okay, we're back with War of the Worlds and Simon Boykov. Simon. Now, we were talking about, very, very, with very strong feelings, okay, you know, against the West. But there are other realities that need to be looked at here. Now, we're talking, what are the actual root causes of all this? Now, I'm not sure if you realize this or not, but Ukraine didn't all of a sudden become a Nazi country in 2014. When the powers of state and the symbols of state were turned over to post-Soviet Ukraine in 1991-92 by the Ukrainian government in exile, they signed a contract that it would be a nationalist state. That's what they would develop. And it was after the politics of Melnik and Simon Petlura. The government had to be something that Simon Petlura would approve of. Petlura never quite got his government off the ground in 1917, 1918, and he murdered over 300,000 people. That was the government. They were nationalist. Every leader of Ukraine at the national level, including Viktor Yanukovych, is a Ukrainian nationalist of some form or sort, and they signed a contract. That is part of the agreement for the state of Ukraine to exist. Now, the Soviets knew this at the time. And as a matter of fact, the only World War II criminal leader, the head of OUNB worldwide, her name is Slava Stetsko. Her husband, Yaroslav Stetsko, ran the pogroms in Lviv in 1941 to celebrate Germany's start of the war, two pogroms he ran, and he declared the state of Ukraine. He was Stepan Bandera's second in charge. She came back to Ukraine in 91-92, started a political party, got elected to the Rada, and is literally the only World War II war criminal of that level to ever hold office. She held it till she died. Are you familiar with the fact that OUNB, her group, Bandera, were the ones that did all the torture and killing at every death camp across Europe? And they committed the Ukrainian Holocaust, another 5.6 million people on top of this. Now, the West tried to stop her, George Bush Sr., and they call it the Chicken Kiev speech, actually forbade that she came back, but he lost to Bill Clinton, who cut a deal with her to get her back in. So from Clinton onward, that's a definite. But even at that time, Russia knew who she was. There's no way of getting around it. They had to know what the setup of Ukraine was. Why wasn't it stopped then? Because there's no way, going from then till now, you could not see this was going to happen. Do you see my point?
Yes. I mean, that's the situation that we're faced with. You mentioned the Ukrainian nationalist heroes. Well, the descendants of the Banderovtsi, the collaborators.
Oh, we're not into descendants. Forget about that. We're into the second generation. Slava Stetsko's party was the Congress of Ukrainian Nationalists. She had a military wing called Tryza Benderi. Her bodyguard was a guy named Dmitry Yarosh. You might have heard his name.
Yes.
Pravi sector leader. The other regional leader of Tryza Benderi was a guy named Andrei Belitsky. They were taught their politics from a first generation World War II Nazi. Ukraine magically, somehow, time warped, skipped a few generations, with the first generation being in World War II politically, in the second generation being in 2014. See, she spent all the time she was in Ukraine, along with the Melnik leader, training the youth in youth groups, Ukrainian scouting like Sum and Plast. And they raised up the generation for Maidan. That's the second generation of Ukrainian nationalist Bandera. So we're not looking at, it's like skipping 70 years in time, because same people are involved. It's crazy like that. But anybody knew this was going on.
1945, 1946, the Red Army was cleaning up Western Ukraine, cleaning up the collaborators. And unfortunately, many of them escaped. They escaped the Red Army and its security units, the NKVD at that time. And they were given these escapees and these collaborators, Ukrainian collaborators who were killing Jews, were killing Ukrainians, were killing Russians, were killing Poles, serving in the SS. Even the German SS were horrified as to the extent of the barbaric approach that they took in these killings. They fled, they got away, and they went to countries like Canada, like Australia. And those people in 2014 who supported and financed and organized the Ukrainian Maidan to overthrow the legitimate government, These are the diaspora people from Australia, from Canada. Like you said, the descendants of these people, a few generations later, were instrumental. Because if we rewind to the Ukrainian coup d'etat when Poroshenko came to power and the right sector and these Ukrainian nationalists took over in Kyiv, at that time they needed a couple of $100,000 here, $50,000 here, $200,000 here, you know, to buy equipment, to buy, to feed the protesters, to hand out money to protesters, to organize temporary toilets, you know, the logistical things, just to get the coup d'etat going, to get the overthrow of the government going. And that money, of course, was supplied in large from the Canadian, from the Australian, Ukrainian Nazi diasporas, because they had an axe to grind. It's this historical battle. And that's how they see this. People like Stefan Romanov in Australia, the direct descendants of the Nazis, the SS collaborators. It's almost as though they had their, you know, take two, their second chance, their second wind at continuing the legacy of their Nazi forefathers, because that's who they were and that's who they are now. And of course, Russia was too kind again. And Yanukovych was weak. Unfortunately, he couldn't put down the coup d'etat. He fled, and this is what we're dealing with.
We've only got about 5 minutes left. Do you know how large a part of the German Wehrmacht the Ukrainians actually were? The German war machine, all branches of military. Now going across the board, do you know what kind of percentage they actually played? Because we talked about it like a small group.
Tell me.
It was about 12. It was about 12%.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about a small group of people. They were at Normandy. They went to Africa. They went to Greece. They went everywhere. These are all the people that are in the diaspora. Now, currently, OUNB has a very, very interesting worldwide leader. Interesting for you, especially considering his location. He's probably not very far from you. There's a guy named Stefan Romanow, and he definitely has a lot of influence in the Australian government. He's been advising them on this the entire time. He's the mouth that's in their ears. He's also the vice president of the Ukrainian World Congress. So they have a lot of lobbying clout everywhere. If a politician wants to get elected in national elections, and this is going in the West worldwide, and especially countries like the US or Australia, you need their money. What do you think about having the head of Bandera worldwide, probably a little more than a stone's throw from where you are right now?
Well, this is exactly what we're talking about. Stefan Romanov is an excellent example of a person who was involved as far back as December 2013. He was on the streets of Kyiv demanding Yanukovych's resignation, supporting, financing, and organizing the anti-government uprising against the legitimate, democratically elected Ukrainian government of that time. 2013, December, he was there on the streets. And this is all documented, this is all available. And he is, in Australia, he was the former Victorian Multicultural Commissioner. And using that position as the Multicultural Commissioner, he had used his influence in Australian politics to get Australia behind all of this. And he's got his fingerprints all over it. And he's not even hiding the fact that he was involved right from the very beginning. When they cry now and they say, oh, help Ukraine, stand with Ukraine, ask for money and weapons, they play the victim. Why don't we rewind and see what was Romanov doing in 2013, December? He was overthrowing the Ukrainian government. He was on the streets with protesters, financing and paying for protesters to use weapons and Molotov cocktails to kill police, to kill security forces on the streets. And this is the beginning of what was going on over there. He's been obviously quite, you could say, quote unquote, fond of my work in Australia, having a pro-Russian balance to what the Ukrainians have here. But we can't underestimate the influence that comes from the West. This situation came from and was organized and financed by people from the West, by people from Canada, very strong Ukrainian diaspora there. Yeah, Australia.
We're still looking at the, the diaspora is the ones that put it together, especially Maidan at the very, very beginning. Digital Maidan was a big one for the Americans. Simeon, we're out of time. I want to thank you for coming on today. It's very, very lively and passionate discussion about this whole situation. And quite frankly, it needs to happen. I hope you'll come back on again soon.
Pleasure, George, and all the best, and our full support to everyone in Donetsk, in the city where you're at. I know you're only a few kilometers from the front line, and God bless you and keep everybody safe in the hero city of Donetsk. We try to do everything we can to support Donetsk, Lugansk, and all of the Russian cities who are fighting for their independence and their freedom from NATO and from the Nazis in Kiev.
Well, thank you again, Simeon.